Well, when I first read these two chapters I had to preach on, I thought, well, I must be the luckiest guy on earth. Either that or I did something really bad on a previous life. Anyway, I read it and read it and read it some more, and now it kind of makes sense. So let's see what we can learn from it. And just a disclaimer, if you haven't noticed, these verses talk about sex quite a lot. So as I will explain, sex is not the main point of the stories, so I won't focus too much on that. But sex is there anyway, and I can't hide it. So as they said on the BBC before the match of the day, if you don't want to see the results now, just look away. Or if you feel uncomfortable, then just, I don't know. Well, apparently, it's true. Men think with their testosterone, the male hormone. Someone at the University of Leuven in Belgium did some research that was published in a magazine, so apparently it was a serious research. And the study concluded that just looking at pictures of sexy women sent men's judgment haywire. In the experiment, which involved hugging and bargaining, the men with higher testosterone levels often drove the hardest bargains. So far, so good. Until that is, the sex factor was introduced. Then the higher the testosterone level, the more the bargaining ability was affected. So if there were no cues around, they behaved normally, but if they saw some sexual images, then they became impulsive. However, men with low testosterone levels were relatively unaffected. I believe this is something women have been saying for ages. I don't think they needed any scientists to prove that. They just knew it. But now there's scientific evidence, apparently. Let's just be grateful that the experiment also proves that not all men are like that. And how is that related to our story? Well, we can easily see that Judah wasn't good at bargaining, definitely. And Joseph was quite a successful businessman. Well, jokes aside, I think these stories in Genesis are sexually charged. And the characters of the stories will have to make decisions on that context. Now, even though the passages talk about sex in every other verse, we need to make sure we read the stories in the proper context, so we can understand why sex is so important for the story. These two chapters about Joseph and Judah are part of the so-called Joseph story, which in turn is part of the patriarch's story. This means that we need to be aware and ask ourselves how these two stories fit in this wider context, how they relate to the promise made to Abraham, and how it helps or prevents the promise to happen. This is crucial. Both Joseph and Judah will play an important role in the future of Israel. Judah will be linked to the southern kingdom, the one that will actually last longer and be restored later. And Joseph will be linked to the northern kingdom, which will vanish very soon from history. So we have to keep in mind the promise to Abraham as we go through these stories of Joseph and Judah. Another thing worth keeping in mind is the different way in which sex is seen in our world today and in the patriarch's world. These verses weren't written in modern Britain, as you may know, and though some of the views about sex haven't changed much, some others are completely different. So when we read these stories, we must bear in mind two things. One, that it's how sex is viewed in a similar way, and another one of how sex is viewed in a completely different way. First, unlike today, sex was not so much about pleasure. Pleasure was there and they knew about it, obviously. But sex was mainly about growing your family, about having descendants and heirs. Just the opposite of today's view, where less children is better so you can use more resources on them. But back then, sex was the means by which your family would grow bigger and stronger and possibly dominant. The more children you had, the more influential your family would be and the better they would do in society. More children was better, and, well, there's only one way to make children, especially back then. So with this in mind, we have to go back to what we just said. Keep in mind the promise to the patriarchs, because sex is the only way that God could fulfill the promise to Abraham when he said, I will make your descendants like the dust of the earth, so that if anyone is able to count the dust of the earth, then your descendants also can be counted. And second, just like today, and as the research I just mentioned proves, sex is still one of the greatest, if not the greatest, temptations, together with money and power, probably. Sex is often used as a paradigm to show, well, to show just how easy it is to fall for it, to surrender to its influence. In books and films, sex is often used as the trick that will get you whatever you want, because nobody can resist it. Sex is able to surrender other wills to its power. In this way, sex comes to illustrate the ability of a person to remain in control or not. It proves whether someone is a man or a woman of principles or a person driven by passion alone. Ultimately proves whether a person is weak or strong, and so if it can be trusted when he or she is put under pressure. So with these three things in mind, the promise to Abraham, sex as a means to procreate, and sex as a paradigm of human weakness, we can now tackle these two stories and see what they are about. The contrasting stories of Judah and Joseph are about God's calling and the ways we can react to it. A very relevant topic for us at Alman, I think. This is what Genesis 38 and 39 are about: one calling and two ways to go. And the first way to go, option one, is the way of opposition. That's what we find in chapter 38 when we read the story of Judah. The first five verses in the story tell lots of important details at great speed. And I think the writer does that in purpose, just to show how little thought Judah put into what he was doing. He just rushed in everything he did without thinking. He leaves his family and the land of the family to live in a foreign land with foreign people. And he takes a foreign wife, and in the language, we see hints that he might have done that by force. So let's look at these things a bit more in detail. We are told at the beginning that Judah left his family and went to live with a man from Adullam, a neighboring region. It's a fairly simple statement, but it's charged theologically with lots of things. If we go back to Genesis 13, verses 12, we read that Abraham settled in the land of Canaan. And after that, the Lord said to Abraham, "Look from the place where you stand, which is Canaan, to the north, south, east and west, and I will give you all the land that you see to you and your descendants forever." And last week we saw that at the beginning of chapter 37, Jacob and his family, including Judah and Joseph, were still in Canaan, the land of the promise. So Judah then leaves his family and the land of the promise. So Judah is effectively deciding to live outside of the covenant, outside of the promises that God made to his ancestors. He then goes and marries a Canaanite woman. Now, the land of Canaan, was the promised land, but the people living there were to be just expelled from there. And even more, we read that Abraham, Judah's great-grandfather, not long before dying, as his senior servant, to find a wife for Isaac, and this is what he says. Abraham said to his servant, "You must not acquire a wife for my son from the daughters of the Canaanites, among whom I am living." And this is what Isaac, Judah's grandfather, told Jacob, Judah's father, when he was sending Jacob away from Esau in Genesis 28. So Isaac called for Jacob and blessed him. Then he commanded him, "You must not marry a Canaanite woman." So I think we don't read in the text that Jacob said the same thing to Judah, but I think we we can assume Judah was aware that his relatives didn't think well of marrying Canaanite women. So we can see now that he's not only living outside of the covenant, but he's also living against it, in opposition to it, because he's disobeying everything his ancestors have said. So at this point, we have to look back at all the stories of revenge, crime, abuse, and other things that have happened in Judah's family before, and hope that God will act again to save the day, despite what the chosen ones decide to do. So with this in mind, thinking that God might still restore the situation, I think it's important that Judah still keeps his duty of having a family. And he does fairly well. He has 3 sons in 2 verses or something like that. But when things went wrong, and his duty was to give his 3rd son, Shelah, to Tamar, he panics. He wants to prevent his son from dying, as if Tamar was some kind of like widow or something like that. He wants to protect his family, but in doing so, he doesn't realize that he's actually killing it. Legally, Shelah and Tamar were engaged, so he could not marry another woman to have children with. And if he couldn't have children with any other women, then the family would stop there. So in effect, Judah was actively deciding that his line of the family would stop there, acting again against God's will of filling the earth. And so Tamar comes into action. It's difficult to say what we make of Tamar's deeds, because, well, I don't know, it's kind of weird. But the Bible seems to bless what she did, even bringing King David and Jesus later from her line of the family. So I'm not really going to argue against that. And if anyone wants to talk about that later, I'm happy to. But who was Tamar? We read that Judah sends her back to his father when the first 2 sons die. And later he demands that she would be burnt alive. Cracking. She also dresses with a veil and waits on the road at the time of sheep shearing. All these things point in one direction. Tamar was probably a Canaanite woman and probably had been involved in the cult of prostitution and fertility rites of the Canaanite religions. And it's this woman, not Judah, one of the 12 patriarchs, not Judah, who had listened to his father and grandfather talk about what God did with them and their family, and all the promises he made about how they would be a blessing to all the nations. It's not Judah, but Tamar, who very likely had been a religious prostitute for Baal and the daughter of a priest. Tamar, the one who is describing this text as the righteous one, the one who is doing God's will. Judah, on the other side, by using sex just for pleasure and not for procreation, puts the cherry on the top and proves once more that he's not fit to carry on God's plans. So Judah takes the way of opposition. Every step he takes, every decision he makes, moves him farther and farther away from the covenant that his ancestors and God made and set him in frontal opposition to God's plans. But there is a second way to respond to God's killing. It's the way of submission. That's option 2. We read in chapter 39, the continuation of Joseph's story. We all know the story of Joseph. We've seen it in movies and theaters everywhere. Not the complete story, but probably Potiphar's story is there. And this chapter, chapter 39, is much easier than 38, not so dark and not so difficult. We see Joseph, like Judah, find himself away from the land and family of the promise. But unlike Judah, he didn't want to be there. He was forced to be in that situation, away from the land and the family. And his attitude is completely different, as is the tone of the text. We read right at the beginning in verse 2, that the Lord was with Joseph, and in verse 3, that his master observed that the Lord was with him and that the Lord made everything he was doing successful. Then in verse 5, the Lord blessed the Egyptian's household for Joseph's sake. And then at the end, even when Joseph is in prison and things seem to be going not so well, we read that the Lord was with Joseph and showed him kindness. And the warden did not concern himself with anything that was in Joseph's care, because the Lord was with him, and whatever he was doing, the Lord was making successful. That is a very different picture from what we read in chapter 38 in Judah's story. In this text, in Joseph's story, the Lord is mentioned a few times in a very positive way. However, I didn't mention earlier, but in chapter 39, the Lord is mentioned just twice. And that's in verse 7 and 10, and this is what they say. But there, Judah's firstborn was evil and in the Lord's sight, so the Lord killed him. And in verse 10, what Onan did was evil in the Lord's sight, so the Lord killed him too. That's quite a different way of action from God. He's just killing everyone on one side and making everything successful for Joseph on the other side. And I think this is because the story is not only, or even mainly, about Judah or Joseph, but about God fulfilling the promises of the covenant. We can see that clearly in that not only Joseph was being blessed, but we are said a few times that Potiphar and his household and the prison keeper and the prisoners were being blessed for Joseph's sake. This way, God's promise to Abraham that in him all the nations of the earth would be blessed was being fulfilled. And so, unlike Judah, Joseph was making the covenant real in his life. So just to make sure that Joseph was really a genuine guy, he's going to be tested to the end where it hurts. Arguably one of the toughest tests a man can resist, sensual woman offering to himself. And under such pressure, Joseph once again succeeds. And the key to his success is found in verse 9. How could I do such a great evil and sin against God, he says. Surely he didn't want to disappoint his master. He knew Potiphar trusted him. But above all, he wanted to please God. Again, in contrast to Judah, who couldn't care less at that point. Joseph was taking an active role in making God's promise real, no matter what the situation. On the other hand, so far, except in the dramatic action of Abraham going to sacrifice Isaac and all a few beads, all we see is that Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob continually fall short of God's expectations. But Joseph is putting faith into action, and that way he's fulfilling the promises to the patriarchs. There was a human part to be played in the fulfillment of God's plan, and Joseph was doing his part. And so, God could start blessing other nations through him in fulfillment of what God says in Genesis 18. For I have chosen Abraham so that he will direct his children and his household after him to keep the ways of the Lord by doing what is right and just, so that the Lord will bring about for Abraham what he has promised him. So in part, the fulfillment of the promise was linked to Abraham and his descendants behaving in a right manner and in a just way. The difference here is that with the patriarchs, God was acting all the time, but he was acting in order to keep the promise alive. Because Jacob, Abraham, and Isaac are continually failing. But with Joseph, God can do what Potiphar did, just sit back and relax. Because it's Joseph who's keeping the promise alive. Joseph is living out his faith so God can concentrate not in saving the covenant, but in fulfilling it. So on this side of the story, Joseph is working hard to please God, and he chooses the way of submission. So this is the story. God made a covenant with his people. And here we find how Joseph and Judah reacted to God's calling. One took the way of opposition, and the other one took the way of submission. Well, it's a nice story, isn't it? Good for Joseph, and not so good for Judah. But how is all that relevant to us today? I think it's very relevant for us today, actually. Especially for Alma after the events of the recent months. These stories are normally applied for the individual, especially the Joseph story, but really these stories mainly talk or are intended to the whole people of God. There is, of course, room for the personal application, but the message is for us all as a unity and bringing God's promises to our life, to our world today, reaching other nations. And we were asked just before, how are we going to respond to the big need of more people helping to reach other nations just from our door, really? That's one way to do it. But it's probably worth asking how Alma fits in God's plans. Not in an abstract way or in the ether, but in real situations. And really, honestly, I'm just asking or thinking aloud, I'm not pointing. I just wish that we can reflect on things that affect our church. Isn't God's will that the churches in general, though I'm concerned with Alma, are a place where people can see God through what we Christians do, as was the case of Joseph? And if so, whether people seeing through the way we have dealt with the recent situation in our church, are they seeing love and fairness? Or are they seeing injustice? Are we planning to improve on that? Are we going to take the way of opposition? Or are we going to take the way of submission and make Alma a bit more the way God would love to? Isn't God's will that His church, including Alma, is a welcoming place where those who are weary and burdened can come and be cared for? Is Alma that place? Have you seen those newcomers and visitors that come and go without anyone talking to them? If you have seen them and done nothing, then that's quite bad. But if you haven't even seen them, then that's really bad. Are we planning to improve on that? Are we going to take the way of opposition, or are we going to take the way of submission and make the effort to leave our good friends for a second and reach for those who are left on their own, whether new or old, so Alma becomes more the church that God wants? Isn't it God's will that Alma is a place where everyone of every age is taken into account? Is Alma that place? Are we neglecting some generations and age groups in favor of others? Are we paying enough respect to everyone, regardless of age? Or are we neglecting some ages, making our church poorer because we're not taking advantage of what everyone can offer? Are we planning to improve that? Are we going to take the way of opposition, or are we going to take the way of submission and make the effort to include everyone, regardless of age, so we can all benefit and Alma becomes more the church that God wants? Other questions could be asked, I guess. These are some that I thought relevant, but please keep asking. As I said, I'm not pointing at anyone, not even me, who honestly should be on top of the list. I just want to provoke some reflection and hopefully help Alma become an even better church. There is one calling and two ways to go. Which way is Alma going to take? Thank you.